Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The image of the blackface minstrel performer, singing, clowning, and dancing as a white audience laughs in derision, is one of the most potent symbols of American racism, and it existed as a popular form of entertainment in America for over 100 years. In today's show, we will explore the history of blackface performances with the author of a new book titled Raising Cain. But before we do that, let's turn to an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1846, Boston dentist William Morton anesthetized a patient who needed a tooth extracted with ether, becoming the first practitioner to use the gas for such a purpose. While ether was previously known for the state of mind it provided users at ether frolics, Morton and chemistry professor Charles Jackson were the first scientists to explore the gas's use in surgery. Unfortunately for Morton, the discovery did not lead to his financial security. Immediately following the tooth extraction, Morton used ether in an operation to remove a tumor from a man's neck. He then sought a patent for his discovery, but was blocked by Jackson, who claimed a part in the process. The issue was never resolved during Morton's lifetime. He spent the last 20 years of his life filing lawsuits against Jackson, dying penniless as a result. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, the failed Bay of Pigs fiasco order by President John Kennedy may have been the first publicized failure of an assassination order given by an American president, but it was apparently not the first time such an order was given. A parliamentary inquiry in Belgium is examining whether the Belgian government assassinated communist Congo leader Patrice Lumumba as a result of an executive order given by President Dwight Eisenhower. In 1975, before a U.S. Senate Intelligence Investigative Committee, Robert Johnson, who was taking notes at a meeting of the National Security Council in 1960, testified that then-President Eisenhower said something to the effect of Lumumba being eliminated. There, the matter rested until recently when it was taken up again in Belgium following publication of a controversial book that claimed that the Brussels government, with the help of the United States, in fact aided in Lumumba's assassination by Congolese rivals. A United States Navy excavation crew recently raised the Civil War-era Confederate submarine H.L. Hunley from its watery grave in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina. On a February night in 1846, during its first military encounter, the manually cranked submarine sank the USS Housatonic. Hours later, though it sustained no damage in the attack, the Hunley sank as well. With the remnants of the Hunley in hand, scientists hope to solve the mystery of the submarine sinking, as well as to learn more about its operation. You're listening to Talking History.
I've been away from you a long time. I never thought I'd miss you so. Somehow I feel your love is real. Near you I want to be.
The image of the blackface minstrel performer is so divisive and controversial that representations of it today, less than 50 years after the NAACP took legal action against the last minstrel shows, usually shocks people into embarrassed silence. But what is the meaning behind this cultural phenomenon? Talking History's Eileen Dugan addresses that subject with Professor William Lehman.
America today is very ambivalent about its blackface performance heritage. Once a popular form of entertainment in minstrel shows and Al Jolson movies, blackface is now commonly viewed as an embarrassment, evidence of our racist past. But should we be so quick to condemn all forms of blackface performance? In what forms has it actually managed to survive to this day? Joining us today to discuss the evolution of blackface performance from its earliest days to the present is Dr. William T. Lehman, Jr., Professor of English at Florida State University. Dr. Lehman is the author of Raising Cain, Blackface Performance from Jim Crow to Hip Hop. Welcome, Dr. Lehman.
Hello.
You begin, interestingly, in your book talking about dancing for eels in 18th century New York. What has that got to do with blackface performance?
Well, it's actually in the 19th century, early 19th century New York. In 1820, there was a market on the Lower East Side of Manhattan called Catherine Market, which was the sort of valve that let goods into the city and, I think, propelled culture out into the United States, because blacks from Brooklyn would come over with goods from the farms, the truck farms, on the Long Island side of the river and sell them to Manhattanites. And when they were through selling their goods, usually the goods of their white owners, because one-third of Brooklyn at that time was enslaved, these young men would dance and compete with other blacks from other parts of the city in dance contests, and fascinated whites would pay them with trash fish like eels or porgies, sometimes small coins. And these were some of the earliest instances of that we know about where whites learned black gestures.
And how did this performance move from the streets to the theater, and with what success?
Well, it was a circuitous movement. The earliest instances that we know about where this fascination took place were about 1820. But the incorporation of blackness into the theater didn't start happening for about another decade. About 1830, when a young man from the neighborhood named Thomas Rice went out west into the Ohio Valley and started dancing a figure he called Jim Crow. And so the Jim Crow dances that were popularized in the Ohio Valley in about 1830 were combinations of dances that Rice had learned at Catherine Market, along with gestures and moves that he picked up from South Carolina blacks as he moved around the country. And there was a figure called Jim Crow that was very popular in black culture at this time, and still remains popular, as a matter of fact, independent of all the phenomena of white copying. And Rice made that very popular in the 1830s. But by the 1840s, there were other New Yorkers, people like Frank Shanfrau, who started incorporating the dancing for eels stuff from Catherine Market in various plays that were some of the earliest very popular theatricals. The most popular plays in New York before Uncle Tom's Cabin were plays like A Glance at New York in 1848 and New York as It Is. And they included young performers dancing, recreating the dances at Catherine Market.
And were these dancers black or white?
They were white dancers on the stage in blackface, because blacks were not allowed to perform in the American theater, until after the Civil War.
So these were the first whites to use the black mask?
Yeah, there had been a minor, Othello, the whites had been performing Othello for a long time, and there had been very few whites performing in black masks until about 1830. It was T.D. Rice, Tom Rice, from the Catherine Market area, who created this performance as a rage, the first fad dances in the first popular culture in the Atlantic, really.
And you make a point about how many of those who adopted the blackface were castaways.
Mm-hmm.
And how can you explain that?
Well, I think what was going on was, young, poor white performers and populations coming together to create figures that had never before appeared on the stage in the Atlantic world. And this disdained population is largely a working class and sub-working class disdained population that other people have called outcasts. Melville called it outcasts, renegades. These people saw in blackness a way of creating on stage figures of their own exclusion. So they identified with blacks as ways of showing the middle class population and their employers and the people who had disdained them how they themselves were being treated. So blackness was a kind of flag for American exclusion. And that's why it became so popular in the early 19th century, before the Civil War. The most popular form of entertainment there was.
So in other words, those who were adopting the blackface weren't doing so strictly out of racist purposes. They weren't always mocking blacks.
It's complex. Certainly there was racism. involved in this cultural production. But that was not the whole story. Just as is racism in Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe, and yet when Lincoln greeted Harriet Beecher Stowe in the White House, he said, famously said, "You're the little woman who started this great war." There were racist images in her book, which ultimately had terrific liberatory power. So, too, in the way T.D. Rice imitated black dances, he was bringing charismatic black gestures before white audiences in ways that, whites clearly profoundly identified with. And he was using blackness as a way to show a kind of rebellion and resistance to middle-class authority that his audience obviously thought was very important.
You also discuss in your book what you call the lore cycle of blackface. Could you explain that?
Yeah, what Rice did and what these early blackface performers did is establish the most important template for American popular culture that has lasted ever since the 1830s. So that in successive waves, whites and blacks have come together to insist that this is the most important strain of American culture, generation after generation. So you have the black theater that Rice started, and then in the 1830s. And then in the 1840s, you get something called the classic minstrel show, which was less theatrical and more like vaudeville. People like Dan Emmett participated in that. And then after the Civil War, it broke into two strands where you had white performers in blackface and also black performers in blackface. That is, black men blacking up in blackface to perform in various ways this business of whites watching blacks and blacks giving gestures to white culture. And then at the end of the 19th century, you had the cakewalk and theater, the early black musical theater of Williams and Walker and others. And then the jazz age in the 1920s and the Harlem Renaissance, and then rock and roll in the 1950s, and then hip-hop culture in the 70s and 80s and to the present. So in successive generations, people keep coming back to these moves which T.D. Rice and other performers in the 1830s established as a kind of template. It says, this is the most distinctive form of American culture. This is the culture which distinctively represents what we've gone through together as a culture as we tried to deal with slavery and class.
You've already mentioned the role of Jim Crow in blackface performance, but you also refer to Cain. Of course, that's the title of your book, Raising Cain. What about Cain?
Cain is the patron saint of outcasts. One of the first performers to write a history of blackface performance was a man named Edward Leroy Rice, and he said that Cain, made the first blackface turn, end quote. And what I think that means is that early blackface performers argued that the mark that God gave Cain was a license for Cain to go out and enact the theater of fraternal strife. You know, Cain, God, instead of killing Cain for killing Abel, God had this odd punishment of you have to go out, Cain, and tell everybody about your crime. And he was scared, and he said, God, if I do that, the Bible says it. Cain said, if I do that, people will kill me. And so God marked Cain with this black mark and said, go out there and do it anyway. And many blackface performers have taken Cain, therefore, as a kind of example of what they're trying to do. That is, enact the story of fraternal strife in ways that will be memorable for people ever since.
In early American cinema, there was a good deal of blackface. One thinks of the Al Jolson films, Eddie Cantor films, and the most famous of them all was The Jazz Singer. And how do you interpret the use of blackface in this film that's now so controversial?
The Jazz Singer, as you know, as everyone knows, is the first talkie film. And it's really remarkable that 100 years after the first blackface performances, The Jazz Singer comes on the scene and inaugurates this perhaps the most important form of American culture production, the Hollywood film. The Jazz Singer is a difficult thing to talk about quickly, but let me just quickly say that if the Jolson character, when the film was known as Jake Rabinowitz, or Jack Robin as he becomes known, if he wants to perform and be a success, and indeed if Warner Brothers as a production company wants to be a success, they seem to suggest that you have to perform blackness. And the question is, to what end? Does Jolson erase his Jewishness in performing blackface? Does he, in becoming white as he does in the film, does he annihilate his Jewishness, or does something more complex occur? Other people have argued that the film is a simplification of identity formation, and that the Jake Rabinowitz character becomes white by performing blackness at the cost of losing his Jewishness. I think the film, quite the contrary, shows something very different. It shows a compounded identity, a man becoming both Jewish and singing Kol Nidre in the Yom Kippur celebrations at the end of the film, living up to his Jewishness, and also having his name in lights on Broadway and performing in the April Follies. So I argue with other critics who say this is a film about the simplification of identity formation. I think it's rather a profound image of complex, compound identity going on at the center of American popular culture.
In your concluding chapter, you provide what I think is a fascinating discussion of MC Hammer and the revival of blackface dance moves. And how do you view this?
Well, Hammer is I was always taken by Hammer's dance. He's not sophisticated lyrically, and his songs are not complex, but as a dancer, he's a brilliant performer. And one of the most interesting questions I think to ask about that was he conscious of what he was doing? And I think not. I think that children are never conscious of the way they inherit the gestures of their parents and their grandparents. People are never conscious of their family identities. And it would be almost impossible for Hammer not to have danced the way he did, given the richness of the tradition of perceived blackness operating in American life by the time Hammer comes along in the 1880s. And so the issue is, for me, is one of just wonder. I'm just amazed at the richness of the kinds of moves that Hammer brings out, and indeed that other rap performers bring out. All the moves that you see in Hammer's choreography are available on the lithograph covers for minstrel song sheets from the 1830s. If you go back and look at the way T.D. Rice moved, or at least the way people represented T.D. Rice moving in the early lithographs, or the way other Dan Emmett and the performers who worked with Dan Emmett moved, you see them doing exactly the same steps that people of Hammer's brilliance, like Michael Jackson and others today, are dancing. So the moves of American culture have remained constant for over 150 years.
All right, well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Dr. Lehman.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Dr. William T. Lehman, Jr., professor of English at Florida State University and author of Raising Cain, Blackface Performance from Jim Crow to Hip Hop.
How I love you, how I love you, my dear old buddy. I'd give the world to be among the hosts here. I even know my man is waiting for me, praying for me down by the money. The hope that's lost.
In 1901, William Hannibal Thomas denounced African Americans as inferior to whites. Further, he blamed blacks, not whites, for the Negro problem, as he termed it, in the United States. So what's new, you ask? Well, for one thing, Thomas was an African-American, and his comment set off a wave of controversy. Here to comment on William Hannibal Thomas's place in history is John David Smith, author of Black Judas, William Hannibal Thomas, and the American Negro.
In 1901, William Hannibal Thomas, his dates are 1843 to 1935, catapulted from relative obscurity to the center of the nation's discourse on race with the publication of his book, The American Negro. In the crudest terms, Thomas denounced African Americans as physiologically, intellectually, morally, and culturally inferior to whites. Blacks, not whites, were the cause of the contemporary Negro problem, Thomas said. That was standard fare for white supremacists during the age of Jim Crow. Thomas, however, was an African American. A mulatto, Thomas deemed mulattoes superior to blacks, whom he considered hopelessly depraved. He argued, however, that light skin alone did not necessarily free a person of African descent from what he considered offensive Negroid traits. Thomas insisted that character held the key to what he cryptically termed the full stature of manhood and womanhood. To mature as a race, Thomas insisted, African Americans would have to model themselves on exemplary white and mulatto figures, men like William Hannibal Thomas. Thomas's book, The American Negro, became a national sensation at the turn of the century. With that book, Thomas stoked the fires of white racism with a force that scores of white bigots could not have hoped to achieve. Because of his African-American origins, contemporary whites considered Thomas an unbiased expert on black inferiority. Small wonder that a broad range of angry blacks judged him a deviant and rallied forcefully to condemn, then to suppress, what they considered his apostasy. They branded him Black Judas. I've spent the last 15 years researching and writing a biography of Thomas. But why should we care about a black negrophobe like Thomas, a man whose opinions on race we find so offensive? First, despite his racial views, Thomas was a man both part of and apart from African-American intellectual life at the turn of the last century. He was one of many African-Americans who wrestled with questions of racial identity. Second, Americans black and white at the fin de siècle debated Thomas's book, The American Negro. Third, Thomas led an interesting life, both complex and contradictory. His personal history and his status as an African-American within the racially polarized world of the 1890s led Thomas to write his magnum opus, the book that made him infamous. Despite then Thomas's repulsive ideas, his story needs to be told. By ignoring those historical figures and subjects with whom and which we disagree, we only tell one side of the story and block historical understanding. By emphasizing only black resistance to white oppression and by transforming all black historical subjects into heroes, we trivialize the complexity of history. Studying Thomas's twisted and tortured life has forced me to reflect on the power of race and the role of personal responsibility in analyzing behavior. Although we find his voice discordant and his ideas disturbing, Thomas nevertheless contributed to the dialogue of race relations during the violent and fearful age of segregation. His black critics were frightened enough by Thomas to take him seriously. So then should we.
You've been listening to John David Smith, professor of history at North Carolina State University and author of Black Judas, William Hannibal Thomas, and the American Negro. This is Talking History. Turning to our recommended historic site of the week, the Underground Railroad is another important part of our past, but like so much of African American history, little has been done to preserve and interpret related historic sites until recently. Here to tell you about New York State's efforts in that direction and some sites you may wish to visit is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The New York Freedom Trail Commission is taking steps to preserve and promote the history of the Underground Railroad in that state. The National Park Service officially lists only 5 Underground Railroad sites in New York, including the Harriet Tubman Home for the Aged in Auburn and the John Brown Farm and Grave Site in Lake Placid. However, officials in New York say there are many more sites, since New York was the first state to abolish slavery and was a frequent stop for Tubman, the most famous conductor on the Underground Railroad. In passing the Freedom Trail legislation, the first in the nation aimed at preserving the history of the Underground Railroad, the commission hopes to preserve sites that are in danger of being forgotten, along with the heroines and heroes. Currently, there are more than 300 sites under consideration for preservation, including the site of the 1843 National Convention of Colored Citizens in Buffalo. For more information about Underground Railroad sites in New York, contact the New York Freedom Trail Commission.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, On October 8th, the Dixon Gallery and Gardens in Memphis, Tennessee, will open an exhibition titled Visualizing the Blues, Images of the American South, 1862 to 1999. The exhibition brings the blues into focus through a collection of classic photographs that show the life, landscape, ambiance, people, and history that gave birth to the blues. On November 2 to 4, the Gallery and the Blues Foundation will co-sponsor a blues symposium at the gallery. For more information, contact the Dixon Gallery in Memphis, Tennessee. Already open at the Southern Cultural Heritage Foundation in Vicksburg is a Mississippi portrait, Farm Security Administration photographs 1935 to 1940. The show features the work of 7 Farm Security Administration photographers who were sent to Mississippi in the late 1930s to record conditions that characterized life in the Deep South during the Great Depression. For more information, contact the Southern Cultural Heritage Foundation in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will begin our month-long series on the history of presidential elections by focusing on the controversial and precedent-setting elections of 1800 and 1824. You won't want to miss this series, which will give you much to think about as you prepare to exercise your constitutional right to vote in November. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I've been away from you a long time. I never thought I'd miss you so. Somehow I feel, though love is real, near you I want to be.